first reading is taken from Jonah chapter 1, verses 4 to 16, which is found on page 774 of the Church Bibles. But the Lord hurled a great wind upon the sea, and there was a mighty tempest on the sea, so that the ship threatened to break up. Then the mariners were afraid, and each cried out to his God. And they hurled the cargo that was in the ship into the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone down into the inner part of the ship and had lain down and was fast asleep. So the captain came and said to him, "What do you mean, you sleeper? Arise, call out to your God. Perhaps the God will give a thought to us, that we may not perish." And they said to one another, "Come, let us cast lots, that we may know on whose account this evil has come upon us." So they cast lots, and the lot fell on Jonah. Then they said to him, "Tell us on whose account this evil has come upon us. What is your occupation and where do you come from? What is your country and of what people are you?" And he said to them, "I am a Hebrew and I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the dry land." Then the men were exceedingly afraid and said to him, "What is this that you have done?" For the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord, because he had told them. Then they said to him, "What shall we do to you, that the sea may quiet down for us?" For the sea grew more and more tempestuous. He said to them, "Pick me up and hurl me into the sea, then the sea will quiet down for you. For I know it is because of me that this great tempest has come upon you." Nevertheless, the men rowed hard to get back to dry land, but they could not, for the sea grew more and more tempestuous against them. Therefore they called out to the Lord, "O Lord, let us not perish for this man's life, and lay not on us innocent blood. For you, O Lord, have done as it pleased you." So they picked up Jonah and hurled him into the sea, and the sea ceased from its raging. Then the men feared the Lord exceedingly, and they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows. This is the word of the Lord.
The second reading can be found on page 834. Matthew chapter 27, beginning at verse 11, on page 834. Jesus before Pilate. Now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. Then Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge, so that the governor was greatly amazed. Now at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the crowd any one prisoner whom they wanted. And they had then a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So when they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ?" For he knew that it was out of envy that they had delivered him up. Besides, while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that righteous man, for I have suffered much because of him today in a dream." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowd to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. The governor again said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ?" They all said, "Let him be crucified." And he said, "Why? What evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he was gaining nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." And all the people answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." Then he released for them Barabbas, and having scourged Jesus, delivered him to be crucified. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks, Margaret. You may want to turn to the book of Jonah. It's very easy to find. It's next to Obadiah. So find Obadiah and you'll find Jonah. Jonah chapter 1, verses 4 to 16. Those of you who know, who were here last week, will know we're looking at this book. It's a very strange book. It's strange because there's this big fish that swallows Jonah whole and then 3 days later vomits him up. So, I mean, that's weird. But everything in the book of Jonah is strange. Nothing is as it should be. Everything is back to front, upside down, and inside out. And so when you start the book, you enter a very disorientating and confusing world. It's a dark world. God is speaking, and he's speaking to Jonah, and he says the evil of Nineveh has come up before me. So what we have is a city whose wickedness is so great that a whiff of it has reached heaven. That smell that reached heaven was not like the smell of sacrificial smoke that rose up from the temple in Jerusalem. Neither was it the pleasing sound of tambourines and praise and psalm singing. Because the smoke that rose from the temple in Jerusalem was sacrificial smoke, and that spoke of the forgiveness of sins. And that cooled God's wrath. That soothed his burning nose. The sound that reached God's ears from the temple were the songs of the redeemed. And they're a joy to him. But the stench that rose up from to heaven from Nineveh was a stench of spilled blood. It was the aroma of violence. And the sounds that reached up into the heavens from Nineveh were the shrieks and cries of the plundered and the abused. There were the sounds of those people weeping and refusing to be comforted. And so when you open the book of Jonah, you're entering a disordered world. A world in which there is distress and darkness and gloom. A world in which men and women do not know their right hand from their left. And so things are not as they should be when you open the book of Jonah. Having met Nineveh, you are then introduced to the prophet. The prophet Jonah. the son of Amittai from Gath-Helpher in Galilee, and you think, at last, the prophet is going to bring a word of hope. Because prophets were those who stood in front of God's face. They were the ones who stood in the inner courts of God's council. They were the members of God's cabinet. They stood in the innermost chambers of heaven, and they had the privilege of the floor, which at times meant that the prophets could speak to God face to face and change his mind. Because God would speak to them, as it were, face to face. And so God, as we know, is the source of all life and love and light in the universe. And the prophets were given messages of life and light and life. But as I say, sometimes the prophets could change God's mind. God said to Amos, I'm going to send a locust swarm. And Amos said, no, please don't. So God relents. But here the word of the Lord comes to Jonah. And he says, Jonah, I want you to go to Nineveh. At last, a message of light and life and love is going to come, right? At last. Jonah is going to bring a message of salvation so that the crooked is going to be made straight. The rough is going to be made smooth. The mountains are going to be brought down and the valleys are going to be lifted up. That's what we're all expecting, right? Except Jonah doesn't even argue with God. Although he has the privilege of the floor, all Jonah does is flee from God's presence, flee from the council chamber, and as he leaves, I can imagine him slamming the door behind him, and so now things are going from bad to worse. And so he refuses to deliver the word of the Lord, and he flees before the face of God. And you see, this is where it gets difficult to preach on the book of Jonah, because what I've been describing is sin. What I've been describing is the outworking of human sinfulness. But this is a problem, especially in 2020, because how can you preach about the idea of sin when the concept of sin is alien to millions of people? They just haven't got any concept of it. Now, let me give you a definition of sin. This is not my definition. This is written by some Anglican clergy in London in 1647. They wrote the Westminster Confession of Faith. And they said, sin is any want of conformity unto and transgression of the law of God. Did you get that? Sin is any want of conformity unto and transgression of the law of God. Now that's spot on. That's what sin is. It's transgression of the law of God. So what the Ninevites were doing was transgressing God's moral laws. And that's what Jonah was doing as well. When God spoke to him and told him to go to Nineveh, Jonah refused and he transgressed the law of God. But what happens when you do not believe that there is a God who has moral laws that you can transgress? What happens if that concept of God, the law, and transgression is completely absent from your way of thinking? What happens then? How do you talk to people about the moral laws of the universe when they do not believe that there are any morals of the universe, because there's no single agent behind the universe? And anyway, the universe shouldn't be called the universe, because that implies a unity of agency and purpose behind the whole world. And rather, the universe should be called the multiverse, because in a multiverse world, there's a whole suite of diverse moral visions springing up from hundreds of different worldviews. How do you talk about the moral law of the universe when you're engaging with people who don't believe it? A friend of mine teaches at a university. And he was handed in a paper about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, that was clearly plagiarized. You know what plagiarism is? Plagiarism is when somebody takes somebody else's essay, takes the name off, and just puts it in as their work. This is what the student did. The professor realized that this work is plagiarized and confronted the student. The student, amazingly, I mean, this is astonishing to me. The student shows no remorse, no embarrassment. None at all. He simply says, oh yes, he says, I like pushing boundaries. I like pushing boundaries. That's what all the great men and women of the past have done. And he mentioned Rosa Parks. You know Rosa Parks? Remember Rosa Parks? In black, racist, segregated America, Rosa Parks stood up and refused to move from a seat so a white person could sit there. And he said, she was pushing boundaries. I'm just like her. I'm pushing boundaries. And what he's saying, do you see this? He's saying, why are you imposing your moral law of universal truth on me? I don't recognize it. I live in a multiverse. And that worldview that you're pushing upon me, I don't recognize it. Now, that's fine. Let me just say, that's fine until you hit a storm. That worldview will survive your multiverse world where you believe in a suite of moral options depending on what environment you're in. That will survive until you hit a storm. A storm that engulfs the heaven above and the earth beneath and everything that in them is. Then everything disintegrates. And that's what hit the sailors. So we're going to look at the sailors. And then we're going to look at Jonah. And then we're going back to the sailors again. Okay, so it goes sailors, Jonah, sailors. Because the sailors are amazing. But I'll start there. The sailors. They're an astonishing bunch. I love them. They're all most probably Phoenicians. That means they're descendants of the Philistines. And these guys are tough men. They're often prepared to take ships where no one else dared to go. So, you know, let's just begin by paying the sailors respect. Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, says that these Phoenician sailors could spend 2 to 3 years sailing around Africa, starting at the Red Sea, down the east coast, around the Cape of Good Hope, up the west coast, through the Straits of Gibraltar, and then back into the eastern Mediterranean. Now just get this. These men went round Africa 2,000 years before the Portuguese explorer Vasco da Gama. So nothing is going to frighten these men. Certainly nothing at sea, because they'd have seen everything that the sea, the wind, and the waves could throw at them. And so there they were, living in their multiverse world. Now you say to me, how do you know they're living in a multiverse world? I say, look at their prayers. Look at the text. For when the storm hit, we are told that the mariners were so afraid that they each cried out to his own God. Right? They each cried out to his own God. Because in a multiverse world, there's no unity in prayer. And that is because in the ancient world, each town, each city, each village, each person had their own pet deity, their own pet god. And so for some, the most important thing for them was money, and so they'd pray to Plutus. For others, it wasn't money so much, it was fertility, and so they'd pray to Venus. For others, it wasn't money or fertility, it was the foods of God and wine, so they were praying to Dionysus, and so all these gods went on and on and on. And the Bible is saying, look at these sailors, look at them. A single unified storm has hit, and that storm has engulfed their whole world. The ship itself has become like a living thing with a mind of its own, and it's threatening to break up. Now, before the storm hit, I dare say, I would venture to think, that these sailors were nominal polytheists. It's like nominal Christians. You know what nominal Christians are like, don't you? I read a story of a chaplain at a hospital, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, his bleeper goes. So he goes to the hospital, and there's a patient. And the patient says, oh, I'm terribly sorry. The patient's really embarrassed. Said, I'm really sorry, I didn't mean to call you out, but what happened is I got some x-rays. And the x-rays say that I've got 2 months to live and I'm soon going to be dead. But I've just realized, terribly sorry, that the x-rays were not meant for me, they were meant for somebody else. So I'm fine, so I don't need you. In other words, what this guy was saying is, I don't need God because I'm fine. I don't want to engage with God unless I absolutely have to. Now, I dare say these sailors were nominal polytheists. But now the storm has hit. And now they have to engage with God. And so they turn to God in their multiverse world, and this is at root what sin is. Now let me explain this to you. I've said that the Westminster Confession of Faith has said that sin is any want of conformity unto and transgression of the law of God. That's an excellent definition. Because you have God, you have the law, and you have transgression. That's it. But what the Westminster Confession doesn't do is tell you the reason why people sin. Why do people transgress the law of God? The reason why people transgress the law of God is because they've turned away from the objective, external, I am who I am. They've turned their back on the one unifying God of earth, sea, and sky, the God of the universe, and they've turned to their internal, multiverse, privatized gods of their heart. And this is what the storm has exposed. Because there they are, all praying to their own gods. And the reason they've done this, and this is what sin is. This is, if you like, the sin beneath all sin. The sin beneath all sin is that we've turned our way from the one eternal God, the Lord of heaven, the earth, and the sea and the sky. And what we've done is we've turned to our own gods. Because we don't think, we do not believe that we can find ourself, our identity as we stand before I am. We think we can find ourselves and our identity as we turn our backs on him. And so there they are, instead of turning towards God, instead of turning towards the creator of the heaven and the earth, they've turned to their own gods. Each one prayed to his own God. And so there they are, praying away. What happens? The storm gets even worse. No matter how much they are praying, their gods don't answer. Their gods remain silent. Their gods are as cold as ice. And you think, why are those gods silent? I'll tell you why those gods are silent. Those gods are silent because those gods are in the boat with them. You notice the cargo. The cargo. That cargo represented to them everything. That cargo represents their lives. It represents to them all their gods. It represents money and sex and power. It represents security and status and standing. It represents life in all its fullness. It's in that cargo, but it's all good for nothing. That cargo is in the boat with them. So what do they do? I love this. They've come to the end of themselves, and what they now do is they throw all the cargo into the sea. Because those gods Your privatized gods that you worship, the things that you turn to for security and peace and comfort in this world, cannot save you. And so they've come to the end of themselves. And they throw the cargo into the sea. What is a man advantaged, says Jesus, if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? So you got the sailors. Who's left? Jonah. Where is he? Jonah is in the bottom of the boat, and we're told that he's fast asleep. I love that. And the captain of the ship goes down to him and says, "Awake! Awake, O sleeper! Call out to your God. Perhaps he can help us." As you read the text, I get the impression, don't you, that Jonah's sleep isn't a normal sleep, is it? It's not normal to be in a storm like that and fast asleep. That sleep that Jonah is experiencing is a kind of death. He's been put to death. And I think in many ways, that's right. Many years later, Paul writes to the Ephesians, the Christians in Ephesus. And he says to them, "As for you, you were dead in your transgressions and sins, in which you used to live, notice that, dead, but you used to live, doing what? Following the ways of this world. When you were all like sheep, you've gone astray, each one has turned to his own way." That's what you are like, said Paul to the Ephesians. You were dead, but now you've been spiritually alive. And so here is Jonah. He's dead, but he's alive. Dead in his trespasses and sins. He's turned his back on God. And now the captain is shouting in his ear, "Awake, O sleeper. Call out to your God." And then did you notice? The questions start coming thick and fast. Did you notice that? Question after question after question, all asking Jonah about his identity. What is your occupation? Where do you come from? What is your country? Of what people are you? In other words, they are asking Jonah, what are you living for? What have you been brought up to believe? What do you value? And Jonah says, "I am a Hebrew." I think that's interesting. The first thing he does is identifies himself by his race. "I'm a Hebrew." And then it's almost as if he realizes that that's not enough. Because just saying, identifying yourself by your race, doesn't really get to the grip of depths of who you are. Because there's something deeper than race. There's something deeper than gender. There's something deeper than the color of your skin. Because there's an identity that goes even further down. And so the sailors ask, "What do you worship? Who is your God?" Because this will tell us who you are. And then it's almost as if Jonah realizes that, because he says, "I fear the Lord, the God of heaven, the sea, and the dry land." I think that's a knockout blow. "I worship the one God of the universe, not the many gods of the multiverse." And when the sailors are told that, they become, we're told, exceedingly afraid. Before they were just afraid. Now they're exceedingly afraid, because what Jonah says, that he's worshiping the God of the heavens and of the sea, what he is in effect saying is, "I worship the God of the storm." Do you see this storm that's touching the earth, the sea, the sky? That's the God I worship. And the sailors are terrified. Because Jonah has already told them that he's running away from this God. It says in verse 10, for the men knew that he was fleeing from the presence of the Lord because he had told them. And now the sailors are horrified. And they cry out to him, "What is this you have done?" "What is this you have done?" And you know, I think of all the questions, that is the question that must have rooted Jonah to the spot. What is this you have done? Because that question, remember, he's a prophet. Jonah knows the Old Testament. That question is the question with which the Bible opens. The Bible opens with the serpent coming to the garden and the serpent saying to Adam and Eve, "Run from your creator, turn your back on him, create your own identity." And so Adam and Eve did. They ran from God and they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil because they were saying to themselves, "We are going to be the judges of what is right and wrong. We're not going to be told what's right and wrong. We're going to define what's right and wrong." And so they said, from now on, we'll be the master and commander, the captains of our souls, the masters of our fate. And so they ate of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And you know what God happens next, don't you? God comes after them like a storm. And God says, "Adam, Eve, where are you?" And then, with a voice like a thunderclap, a voice like the sound of mighty rushing waters, a voice like the sound of an approaching storm, God calls out and says, "What is this you have done?" That's the very question the sailors are asking Jonah. What have you done? It's the same question that Nathan the prophet asked David after he slept with Bathsheba and murdered Uriah. Nathan the prophet comes to David and says, "What is this that you have done?" And you can hear, can't you? Can't you hear the shock and horror and dismay in their voices? Who can help them now? And then they say, "What shall we do?" Notice this. "What shall we do to you? What shall we do to you so the sea may quieten down for us?" Notice that. What are we going to do to you so the sea may quieten down for us? Now, I want you to put yourself in Jonah's shoes. There he is on the deck of this heaving ship. And just like the sailors have now come to themselves, he has also come to himself. He's coming home. He's reached the end of the tether. And he knows that all this has happened because of him. He knows that. He says that. He says, "It's not your fault. It's not you over there that's to blame. It's me. And now because of him, all these other people are going to die because of what he's done." And so his heart is starting to melt. His heart is starting to be broken. And so now I think for the first time he looks at these sailors and he loves them. He's filled with compassion with them because this is not how it should be. He says, "You are about to die because of me. You should not die for me. I am the one who should die for you," right? That works out. That's how it should be. That's how this world should work. And so he says, "Pick me up, throw me into the sea, hurl me into the sea head first. Throw me in so I go down all the way to the bottom." And Jonah is saying, "I will die so you can live." I'm coming to the end. We've looked at the sailors. We've looked at Jonah. Let's turn back to the sailors again because this is just absolutely amazing. Because now we're told again, that they are exceedingly afraid. That's the second time it says that about the sailors. They're exceedingly afraid. And so you think, well, why are they afraid again? I think for two reasons. They suddenly realize that the God that they're dealing with is the God of the earth, the sea, and the sky. And Jonah has said, throw me into the sea, but they don't want to throw him into the sea because they know if they throw him into the sea, he will drown. And they're now worried because they're conscious of I Am, who's a moral God and a moral agent who holds people to account. They now think, is this man's blood going to be on our heads? We do not want to be guilty for this man's blood. But the storm won't stop. So they don't want to throw him in, so they try and do some rowing. It doesn't work. The storm gets even worse. And so now they throw Jonah into the sea, and immediately there's calm. And now they're afraid again. Why are they afraid again? They're afraid of the wrath of God. And now they're stunned. They're stunned that God has accepted Jonah's sacrifice of love for them. They can't believe it. They can't believe that that man so loved them that he was willing to die so they might have life. And so now they are exceedingly afraid. My friends, do you know what this is doing? It's almost obvious, isn't it? You now know where I'm going, don't you? Because at the end of his life, Jesus was standing in front of Pilate. And Jesus is going to go down into the storm. He's going to down, it's not just a storm in the Mediterranean. He's going to go down into the storm that's going to end all storms. This is the final storm. This is the only storm. Let me put it to you like this. This is the only storm. Death is the only storm that can completely destroy you. But Jesus goes down into it. Now, they don't believe. They refuse to believe that. So when Jesus is about to go to his execution, they don't do what the sailors did. The sailors said, please, Lord, do not let this man's blood be on our heads. These people say, let his blood be on us and on our children's children. My friends, we're going to be celebrating communion. And you're going to come forward and take the cup, the symbol of God's love for you. And as you take that cup, pray that you're stunned and amazed and overwhelmed because you can see that God sent his son to die for you, to go down into the storm, so you can be free. Now, if you're a nominal Christian and don't really believe that, or just are outwardly confessing it, I guess it doesn't matter very much to you. But pray, let's all pray, that we become stunned and amazed that Jesus went down to the storm for us. So it's not that his blood is on us, but our blood is on him. Let's bow our heads to pray. Heavenly Father, we praise and thank you for this book of Jonah. We thank you that Jesus looked on us and had mercy on us and compassion on us, so that he went down to the storm in our place. Father, we recognize that we have done terrible things. We've turned away from you, the source of light and life and love, and pursued our own gods. Father, forgive us and give us grace to turn back to you. In Jesus' name, amen.